Well, as long as we're gonna think about having a party later anyway, it is fortuitous that the last theme I want to look at in Esther as we read these last couple of chapters together. It's really just two chapters. Chapter 10 is a little midget chapter of three verses. I want to take a look at the partying that they do in this book. There are actually 10 banquets. We're not going to look at them all. But they really give the book a huge skeleton or frame to work from. Between the opening feast that turns out to be a big domestic dispute between Ahasuerus and Vashti, to Esther's wedding banquet and all of the banquets that she throws in anticipation of petitioning the king, and all the
you gotta eat,
you gotta have your strength up or something like that. And then, of course, I keep giving away the ending before we actually get there. This must be the most miserable storytelling experience ever for you guys. But it ends in a huge party, which we'll read about together today. And, of course, the book itself is a party book in the sense that it's one of the five scrolls that's read in total and separately for one of the major feasts on the Jewish holiday calendar. The other ones, I mean, some of them are sort of, the other scrolls connected to the other holidays, some of them sort of make sense, some of them sort of don't. Esther is connected to Purim, and that's pretty straightforward since the book is all about the history of the Purim festival and why they have it. Passover is one of the festivals as well, and I am told that the book that you read then is the Song of Songs, the Song of Solomon, which I cannot work out without further study. I have no insight into that for you. Ruth is associated with the Festival of Weeks, the Feast of Weeks, or Pentecost, which makes sense if you think that most of that story takes place in a grain harvesting setting, and that's what that festival is about. The ninth of Av, the month of Av, sort of observes the fall of the temple, as I understand it, and the Book of Lamentations is read. So that sort of makes sense. And then the other, the final of the fifth of the five festivals is Sukkot, the Festival of Booths. You read Ecclesiastes, I don't know why. But those are them. Those are the five festivals and the five scrolls, of which one is Esther. More trivia, the word banquet, mishteh in Hebrew, is used more in this book than any other book in the Bible, certainly in the Old Testament in the Hebrew. And as long as we're thinking about banquets and feasts and celebrating some later ourselves anyway, the big question is, how drunk do you have to be to enjoy a party? This is the big question about Esther, not just because we see people drinking a lot.
I ask myself every day.
What's that?
I ask myself every day.
Right. It's a hard question, I know, the state the village is in right now, being a dry village. But this is actually a big question, and the Talmud has a big answer for it. The Talmud being sort of rabbinical reflections on the Old Testament that come and get written later, commentaries, basically. A glossa ordinaria, just in Hebrew. And so, how drunk are you supposed to be to enjoy a good party? You should be so drunk that you cannot tell a difference between the phrases, blessed be Mordecai, and cursed be Haman. You should not be able to tell which is being said. You should be having that much fun.
I'm so confused.
It's true.
Have you been drinking?
Just Lutheran, it's the saint sinner thing blended into one big drunken moment.
Right. Well, and actually, so now two geeky things that go with this observation. One, there is a way of counting in Hebrew. It came up last week, actually, in one of the teaching sessions, but it just has to do with the letters of the Hebrew alphabet, each being assigned a number, and so you add up the letters in a word, and you get a number, and it's something you can do sort of numerological things with it. It's more often just used in school, like riddles. It's like a word problem, an odd word problem. So you solve it, and then you check your answer by seeing if you got the right number. But if you add up the letters in the Hebrew phrase, blessed be Mordecai, and the letters in cursed be Haman, you get 502 both times. So there is a way to sort of not tell the difference between them. They are algebraically equivalent. The better dorky thing, actually, it's funnier. I mentioned all the way back in my pitch for this class, when I said, no, really, we're going to study Esther, that one of the pub trivia thing, the thing everybody knows about Esther, is that the name of God is not mentioned. And one of the explanations, I mean, people speculate on this, and there's lots of explanations. We came across the observation that, well, Mordecai, Esther, Marduk, Ishtar, maybe this is just a barely Jewish retelling of a pagan myth, so it's not appropriate to have God's name in there. That would just be inappropriate and embarrassing. We came across the sort of deeper observation that this is a period in Israel's history when, in a way, God is sort of veiled because the temple has been, you know, taken away. It's not really clear what it means to be a Jew in this time, and it's hard, you're sort of having this identity crisis of how can we be the chosen people when historically we're sort of clearly not, because all of these horrible, tragic things have happened. So maybe that's why God doesn't actually appear in the book, because sometimes that's just what life is like. Sometimes that's just what the world is like, and you can sort of face that reality and try to hold on to certain things, but sometimes you just have to admit that you cannot see God. So that's a sort of deeper reading of it. And then my favorite answer, and the one that's appropriate to this conversation, is that maybe the name God doesn't appear in this book because there's actually a Jewish tradition that you're not supposed to say the name of God out loud. So whenever the name, the tetragrammaton, the four letters, Yod Hey Vav Hey, that you could pronounce Yahweh, and that's the divine name that the Lord uses to introduce himself to Moses in Exodus. So whenever that name appears in the Old Testament, you're not actually supposed to read it aloud. And most translations of the Bible actually preserve this, so that's why you're reading along and you get to the Lord in all capital letters, because they're preserving that tradition of not actually saying the divine name. And the way you do that in Hebrew is you leave the consonants there, Yod Hey Vav Hey, but you give it new vowels. You give it vowels to match the Hebrew word for Lord, which is Adonai. And that's why if you put the consonants and the vowels together, you get a funny word that you would pronounce Jehovah. So that's where that comes from. But the idea is, if you're really drunk, that's confusing. In fact, if you're really sober, that's confusing. So what you really don't want to do is read this book during a big drunken party and accidentally say the name of the Lord out loud. And that is why it doesn't appear in the book. Now you know.
Smart and kind.
So yeah, so that's a possibility. Just a couple of sort of notes about the Festival of Purim, and then we'll get into the text proper and actually see how we get to it. It's been, you know, I don't really have a good modern experience of how Purim is celebrated among the Jews. I've never been to synagogue on that day. I've never hung out with Jews on that day. I have hung out for modern celebrations of Passover. I've been to Passover Seders. I've been to Passover Seders that Christians have sort of tried to do, which are very staid and observant and careful and honoring the tradition. And then I've been to ones that Jews have hosted, which are so much better because they're just big parties and they're for the kids. And we sing lots of songs. And this one was for a bunch of, the one I'm thinking of, was for a bunch of sort of graduate students and choir members and dramatic people and sort of socially aware people. And it had to be a vegan Passover, so we had Passover yam instead of Passover lamb. But we sang a bunch of traditional songs, or rather not traditional songs, but songs that, well, so this is what I mean. They were set to, like, Christmas carol tunes and Disney song tunes, and my favorite was the one that was set to the Little Mermaid song, Under the Sea, and it was through the Red Sea, and it was this whole thing, until you got to the verse about the Egyptians, and then it was back to Under the Sea. Jewish parties are fun, and Purim is no exception, even though it's celebrating something, as we'll see in the text.
It's more fun than Passover.
Really? Okay.
Because you don't have to sit through all the stuff. Okay. You just party.
Can you give us a brief image of what, or a...
I mean, in my temple, like. It was, again, like a big kids thing.
I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. Everyone dressed, we had you don't call it a parade, but like a pageant. We had like a pageant.
Yeah,
and
okay.
Everyone dresses up in the characters of the story of Esther. And you run around and you read Torah and clackers when you hear, come on. And
see, I didn't make
then
that up.
You feast. Yeah.
That is awesome.
Yeah.
That is awesome. Yeah, that's everything I have. So good. All right. So while we're thinking about our own party that we're going to get to, let's start thinking about the party that Esther is going to introduce us to. It's a fun one. We're starting at chapter 8 today. So we've just had the big climactic confrontation. Esther has finally had, given it one more go at having a feast. They're 2 days into the feast. And the king asks her, what can I do for you? And she asks for her life. And when he asks, who has sought your life and the life of your people? She points to the guy sitting next to her, and that's awkward. And things do not go well for him. When we closed chapter 7, his face was covered, which is sort of a traditional thing, I guess, for you are guilty, you are going to be no more. And he was hung on the gallows that he had prepared for the hero Mordecai. So he got punishment that fit the crime, which we've seen before in stories. But starting at chapter 8, so let's see. I mean, the cliffhanger of yesterday was, all right, we've gotten rid of the villain. We've gotten rid of Haman. But what are we going to do about this edict? Because we already know from earlier in Esther that laws here cannot be revoked. So what are they going to do about this thing, this edict, just having gone out on the Persian Pony Express? Let's read verses 1 through 8 of chapter 8.
On that day, King Ahasuerus gave to Queen Esther the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, and Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told what he was to her. Then the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai. So Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. Then Esther spoke again to the king. She fell at his feet, weeping and pleading with him to avert the evil design of Haman, the Agagite, and the plot that he had devised against the Jews. The king held out the golden scepter to Esther, and Esther rose and stood before the king. She said, "If it pleases the king, and if I have won his favor, and if the thing seems right before the king, and I have his approval, let an order be written to revoke the letters devised by Haman, son of Hammedatha the Agagite, which he wrote, giving orders to destroy the Jews who are in all the provinces of the king. For how can I bear to see the calamity that is coming on my people? Or how can I bear to see the destruction of my kindred?" Then King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther and to the Jew Mordecai, "See, I have given Esther the house of Haman, and they have hanged him on the gallows because he plotted to lay hands on the Jews. You may write as you please with regard to the Jews in the name of the king, and seal it with the king's ring, for an edict written in the name of the king and sealed with the king's ring cannot be revoked."
Okay. So the petition, again, was to write to revoke the letters devised by Haman. But it doesn't look like that's going to work, because the last words of Ahasuerus here is, well, something sealed with the king's ring cannot be revoked. So it's not quite as simple as they want it to be. So write let's see, you may write as you please with regard to the Jews in the name of the king, seal it with the king's ring. So they have to come up with something new. How are they going to do that? Now it becomes very interesting to read chapter 8 in parallel with chapter 3, which is where, so follow along with either, but chapter 3 is where Haman writes his edict. And so if somebody can be in charge of reading along in chapter 8, just one verse at a time, and I'm going to start at chapter 3, verse 12, and we're going to see just how creative they get with writing the new edict. So I'm at chapter 3, verse 12, and if somebody could start with chapter 8, verse 9.
The king's secretaries were summoned at that time in the third month, which is the month of Sivan, on the 23rd day, and an edict was written, according to all that Mordecai commanded, to the Jews and to the satraps and governors and the officials of the provinces from India to Ethiopia, 127 provinces, to every province in its own script and to every people in its own language, and also to the Jews in their script and their language.
Perfect. Now, chapter 3, verse 12, and just before I read it, notice the time. We're not in the month of Nisan anymore. So there's been a sort of time skip here. And some editors think that, okay, this section of the text that we just started comes later and gets interpolated, but what was happening in the banquets was still in Nisan, so it has that Passover parallel. It gets really hard to tell, but we do get this specific time note here that we're in the month of Sivan, the 23rd day. Sivan is the third month, so we're not in Nisan anymore, and we're not in the first month. We've gone 2 months ahead, and we're on day 23 instead of day 13. That means 70 days have passed, which is a big completion number. 7 and 10 together is special and stuff. So just a brief note on that. But now, having heard verse 9 of chapter 8, here's chapter 3, verse 12. Then the king's secretaries were summoned on the 13th day of the first month, and an edict, according to all that Haman commanded, was written to the king's satraps and to the governors over all the provinces and to the officials of all the peoples, to every province in its own script and every people in its own language. It was written in the name of King Ahasuerus and sealed with the king's ring. Pretty close. Did anybody spot the difference?
The second one talked about being written specifically in the language of the Jews.
Yes, the Jews got one too this time. Yeah. I mean, there might be another tiny thing, but that's the one that jumps out at me too. Yeah, we also, and you know, for good reason. Maybe we don't know what's in the edict yet. Let's find out. Andrew, you were reading for me, right? All right, want to keep going with verse 10?
He wrote letters in the name of King Ahasuerus, sealed them with the king's ring, and sent them by mounted couriers riding on fast steeds bred from the royal herd.
Okay. I've got letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces giving orders to, I'm going to jump into verse 11 here, but giving orders to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all Jews, young and old, women and children, in one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to plunder their goods. Go ahead and give us verse 11 there.
By these letters, the king allowed the Jews who were in every city to assemble and defend their lives, to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate any armed force of any people or province that might attack them, with their children and women, and to plunder their goods.
And 12.
On a single day throughout all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is in the month of Adar.
Okay. Again, pretty close. This doesn't seem to be a particularly creative writing exercise, as creative writing exercises go. This is pretty close in parallel. But again, there are some specific differences. Look at the language of verse 11 compared to what I'm reading. And again, here's how it is in verse 3. Giving orders to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all Jews, young and old. And what is the parallel phrasing there in verse 11?
The king allowed the Jews.
Yeah. The king allowed the Jews who were in every city to assemble and defend their lives, destroy, annihilate, kill. Okay. But any armed force of any people or province that might attack them. So slight change here, you know, rather than orders to go out and target and destroy, it's allowed, very good catch, to be very violent towards people who might attack them. I mean, this goes back to the end of chapter 3 when this edict first comes out and Susa is just thrown into confusion. You know, it's when we talk about there being enemies of the Jews in this empire, enemies of the Jews in this text, it's not just everybody, it's not just all of the Gentiles, it's Gentiles versus Jews, and it's a dog-eat-dog world. It's, you know, there are enemies of the Jews who are a specific subset of the Gentiles. It's not just everybody. It's not, the Jews aren't being told to attack all of the people. They're being told to attack anybody who might attack them. Or rather being given permission to do that. An important change. Let's carry it through. Andrew, you want to keep going with verse 13?
A copy of the writ was to be issued as a decree in every province and published to all peoples. And the Jews were to be ready on that day to take revenge on their enemies.
All right, and verse 14 in chapter 3, for those keeping track at home. A copy of the document was to be issued as a decree in every province by proclamation, calling on all the peoples to be ready for that day. So again, important differences. Be ready for that day versus be ready for that day to take revenge on their enemies. So the Jews are getting slightly more specific instructions. And then just to finish it out, verse 14, Andrew.
So the couriers mounted on their swift royal steeds hurried out, urged by the king's command. The decree was issued in the citadel of Susa.
Okay. Mounted on their swift royal steeds. We get that in verse 14 of chapter 8. But listen to how they go out in chapter 3, verse 15. The couriers went quickly by order of the king, and the decree was issued in the citadel of Susa. So this one, this later writ, gets a little bit nicer treatment. And there are exegetes who like to say, there's the Old Testament in chapter 3 and the New Testament in chapter 8, and these are sort of symbols of these two different things. And the swift steeds, the swift royal steeds, are like the apostles and prophets, you know, the really good preachers spreading the gospel message. Whatever the meaning behind that difference, there is a difference there. The second edict is going to get swift royal steeds in a phrasing that actually really, it's, oh, what do they call it? There's a specific word for it, a word or a phrase that only occurs once in the Hebrew. It'll come to me at about 447, I think. There is a word for it. And now, so just to give you how things end in chapter 3. So once this decree is issued in the citadel of Susa, the king and Haman sat down to drink. But the city of Susa was thrown into confusion. We're not going to have drinking quite yet because there's a difference between drinking before your plot has been carried out and waiting until you're successful and then sitting down to have a drink. But nevertheless, the king and Haman seal the deal in that way. But the Jews are not going to get to their party quite yet. So again, not the most creative as far as creative writing assignments go, but the changes, few though they are very, very specific. And we can kind of see the difference here as far as, I mean, that's the big thing, right? Let's order the slaughter of all the Jews in the first one versus the Jews being given permission to defend themselves in the second. So that's the big solution. And that takes us through to verse 15 of chapter 8. And verses 15 and 16, we've had to wait so long for another set of these, but these are more redemption verses. So traditionally, when this scroll is being read aloud, these are two more verses that would be read by the entire congregation to wake everybody up, and also because they're important. So verses 15 and 16 together in all of our different versions, let us read.
Then Mordecai went out from the presence of the king, wearing royal robes of blue and white, with a great golden crown and a mantle of fine linen, while the city of Susa shouted and rejoiced. For the Jews there was light and gladness, joy and honor. And every
that was stop. That was it. And that's pretty beautiful, actually. For the Jews there was light and gladness, joy and honor. This is another place where interpreters have wanted to see God behind the text, and you can imagine why. I mean, behind that beautiful phrasing. And the gloss on this is that, well, light is Torah. The Jews had light. The Jews had Torah. The Jews had gladness, holiday and celebration. The Jews had joy, which is identified as circumcision. Somebody can explain to me that one, but anyway. And honor, which is sort of the ability to obey the commandments and have them written, carry them with them again. But they're not said directly, the gloss continues, because the essence of redemption is not these things. It's not the commandments. It's not necessarily Torah. It's not necessarily circumcision. It's this spiritual sort of light. It's just that ineffable, indescribable thing. And the best we can do is call it light and gladness and joy and honor. Now somebody can continue. Let's pick up at verse 17 and just finish out chapter 8 here.
In every province and in every city, wherever the king's command and his edict came, there was gladness and joy among the Jews, a festival and a holiday. Furthermore, many of the peoples of the country professed to be Jews because the fear of the Jews had fallen upon them.
So that's a weird
peoples
thing.
Have
Yeah, that's kind of the essence of the book, actually, is that phrase right there. The tables have turned. The opposite happened. A great reversal has occurred. Professed to be Jews. Now, a couple centuries later, like 500 years into the Common Era, there will be actual rules laid down as to what constitutes Jewish conversion, conversion to Judaism. And this wouldn't have quite passed muster, just being afraid. Doesn't quite fit the rules. But nevertheless, people are, in one way or another, professing to be Jews, because fear of the Jews had fallen upon them. This is another way that Esther doesn't quite fit with the tenor of other books in the Old Testament, because it's fear of the Jews, not fear of the Lord. So, you know, for what that's worth, I don't fully know why it's that and not the other thing. I mean, you sort of, you read the story of Jonah, for example, and see the Ninevites convert fully and be praying, and the fear of the Lord falls upon them. But in Esther, it's the fear of the Jews, which might just go, actually, with the sort of limited point of view of the book, with God not necessarily appearing, because sometimes that's just what the world is like. And sometimes as far as you can get is being afraid of, you know, not God, but on your way to God. At least you have a healthy fear of the people God is clearly taking care of.
I don't get the impression that they've converted to be Jews.
Oh, say more.
You know, I just get the impression that they're like, uh-oh.
Yeah.
No.
Not only am I not an enemy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's totally fair. I mean, like I said, this is a pretty inadequate substitute for, you know, a would-be convert. It's a pretty weak reason. But one way or another, I mean, they're sort of identifying themselves with the Jews. Whether as Jews, with Jews, yeah. So I think that's a very fair reading, absolutely, of what's going on. So what happens 9 months down the road when we finally get to the month of Adar? Let's pick up with chapter 9 here. And somebody very brave is going to have to volunteer, but I do give you permission to sort of skip verses 7, 8, and 9. But let's go ahead and read 1 through 10.
On the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, the king's order came into effect. This was the very day that the enemies of the Jews had planned to overpower them, but the tables were now turned. The Jews overpowered those who hated them. The Jews had gathered in the cities throughout King Xerxes' provinces to lay hands on those who were seeking their ruin. Not one man was able to stand up against them. Fear made cowards of them all. What's more, all the government officials, satraps, governors, everyone who worked for the king, actually helped the Jews because of Mordecai. They were afraid of him. Mordecai by now was a power in the palace. As Mordecai became more and more powerful, his reputation had grown in all the provinces. So the Jews finished off all their enemies with the sword, slaughtering them right and left, and did as they pleased to those who hated them. In the palace complex of Susa, the Jews massacred 500 men. They also killed the 10 sons of Haman, son of Hammedatha, the archenemy of the Jews. Parshandatha, Aspatha, Adalia, Pramashta, Aridai, Dalphin, Paratha, Aridatha, Arasai, Vaisatha. But they took no plunder. That day, when it was all over, the number of those killed in the palace complex was given to the king.
Wow. You did it. You got through all of those 10 names. Very great. Just, I'll ask you to go on, but just a brief note here. We see just a couple of interesting things in the text going on. When you get to those 10 names of Haman's 10 sons, the Hebrew word there, they killed, is a very specific word. It's harag is how you say it, I guess. But it does mean killed, like, in battle. I mean, they were in the melee. So it wasn't just like, let's avenge the 10 sons of this guy specifically, like they weren't involved. Like, they were involved. So they were among the enemies of the Jews who were bothering to come out and follow the edict. But the other really interesting note, and you're going to hear this phrase a couple more times as we go on, but just look at the way verse 10 ends. So they've killed these 10 sons of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, but they did not touch the plunder. This seems to be a very specific echo of Saul's failure back in 1 Samuel chapter 15, when Saul, Mordecai's ancestor, comes up against Agag, Haman's ancestor, Haman the Agagite's ancestor, because Saul is ordered to blot out the memory of Amalek from all remembrance. He doesn't do it. He saves some of the plunder. We're just going to sacrifice it and stuff like that. But, I mean, he specifically disobeys the word of the Lord that came to him through Samuel. But the Jews in Esther are going to be very, very particular about not touching the plunder. Okay, continue on. Take us through to, let's go to verse 17 all the way, verses 12 through 17.
The king told Queen Esther, "In the palace complex alone here in Susa, the Jews have killed 500 men, plus Haman's 10 sons. Think of the killing that must have been done in the rest of the provinces. What else do you want? Name it and it's yours. Your wish is my command."
This is one of those things where you sort of really want to hear the tone of how he's saying these things. You know, is he just fine with this? Is he aghast? Is he bewildered? But given Esther's reaction, we can sort of make some assumptions about how happy or unhappy he is. Okay, thank you.
"If it please the king," Queen Esther responded, "give the Jews of Susa permission to extend the terms of the order another day, and have the bodies of Haman's 10 sons hanged in public display on the gallows." The king commanded it. The order was extended. The bodies of Haman's 10 sons were publicly hanged. The Jews in Susa went at it again. On the 14th day of Adar, they killed another 300 men in Susa, but again they took no plunder. Meanwhile, in the rest of the king's provinces, the Jews had organized and defended themselves, freeing themselves from oppression. On the 13th day of the month of Adar, they killed 75,000 of those who hated them, but did not take any plunder. The next day, the 14th, they took it easy and celebrated with much food and laughter.
Oh my God.
Such a
awesome
weird
It is. What translation is that?
The Jews went back at
the message.
It's the message. Okay. Oh. The paraphrase. All right. No, I love that. Like in verse 15, it's like they were at it again. And then they took it easy in verse 17. So this is now the point in the text when it just gets to be really hard to keep apologizing for what's going on. You can sort of say when the edict is published, well, they've been given permission. They're not, you know, it's not the same as an order to go out and just slaughter willy-nilly. It's, you know, it's sort of a controlled thing. And oh, they're not touching the plunder. Isn't that nice? But when Esther asks for an extra day, it gets to be really hard to sort of continue celebrating without wondering what's going on.
It almost sounds to me as though she always had it in mind that these sons would be hanged and that it hasn't been done yet, so she needs that extra day.
Sure, sure.
They don't have time to plunder, they're too busy killing.
Right.
In the notes below here, it says that she doesn't specifically ask for a day, that it's open-ended.
Oh, really?
True. Yeah.
Okay, I've always understood it to be just an extra day. But yeah, either way, I mean, it's just, you know, what else do you want, Esther? Well, more killing, if it's all right. You know, it's a hard one. If you sort of spiritualize what's going on here, with which plenty of exegetes have wanted to do, sort of throughout history, and just make the enemies of the Jews into sort of a spiritual thing, then sort of, you know, partial and then complete conquest of something like sin or the passions gets to be a little easier to deal with. So there's a medieval exegete who I spent a little bit of time with before I came out here, named Rabanus Maurus, who likes to observe that, oh, this is happening in the 12th month, so it's the last age of the world when our Redeemer became incarnate, and the preaching of the gospel spread throughout the whole world, and that the Jews' revenge represents the whole assembly of the faithful, where true confession of the right faith resides, and where those are, you know, we are helped by the grace of God to conquer our enemies, which are, you know, sort of personal demons and things like that. So there's a really strong tendency to sort of spiritualize what's going on here. But there it is, and it's in the Bible, and we have to deal with it. Sometimes that happens. And sometimes, you know, it's Jesus. Sometimes it's Jesus saying that, you know, that guest was not dressed properly for the wedding feast, so he needs to be cast out and where there is weeping and gnashing of teeth. It's not our fault, it's Jesus that said it. Sometimes things like that are just hard and in scripture and there to be dealt with. I don't have all the answers, I just read a couple books before I got here. But that's what's going on in chapter 9. All right, the festival of Purim is inaugurated. So how is this melee going to be commemorated? Starting at verse 18, let's go to verse 22. And again, it was verses 20 through 22 that were the sort of coda when this once every 3 years gets read in Christian churches. I mean, this is the passage that sort of makes the cut as acceptable things to talk about in a church. So verses 18 through 22, let's hear what's going on here.
But the Jews who were in Susa gathered on the 13th day and on the 14th and rested on the 15th day, making that a day of feasting and gladness. Therefore the Jews of the villages who lived in the open towns hold the 14th day of the month of Adar as a day for gladness and feasting, a holiday on which they send gifts of food to one another. Mordecai recorded these things and sent letters to all the Jews who were in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, both near and far, enjoining them that they should keep the 14th day of the month Adar and also the 15th day of the same month, year by year, as the days on which the Jews gained relief from their enemies, and as the month that had been turned for them from sorrow into gladness, and from mourning into a holiday, that they should make them days of feasting and gladness, days for sending gifts of food to one another and presents to the poor.
So having seen where chapter 9 took us before this, it kind of makes sense that this is the bit that nicely closes the reading as the lectionary laid it out. Mourning into gladness is something that we've certainly seen in Psalms and in other parts of Scripture. And it's a beautiful thing. Days of feasting and gladness, days for sending gifts of food to one another and presents to the poor. We're coming up on the hour, so I'm not going to make us march through the rest of the text, but actually that would have been really boring anyway, because the rest of chapter 9 just kind of repeats, and Mordecai sent letters and said celebrate stuff. And chapter 10 is just a quick coda about how much power Mordecai gains, which we've also heard about in other parts of chapters 8 and 9. So you can consider yourselves having marched to the end of Esther. And a last observation that I'll make. I mean, again, we've looked at this book as a book that is odd as far as fitting into the rest of the Hebrew canon. It always comes back to how it really doesn't do things that we expect books in the Old Testament to do. It doesn't mention things that we expect books in the Hebrew Old Testament to mention. And it sort of goes back to that verbal connection between the Hebrew word for world, olam, and the Hebrew word for conceal, which is the verb alam. It's the same word, the root is connected. And the idea being that the world is not necessarily a place that you can see the fullness of God. Sometimes it's a very, very confusing place, which is why we share the good news, which is why we preach. But sometimes things are just dark, and sometimes God is just hidden. And the answer to all of that in Esther is to throw a party. It's to hang out with your friends. It's to drink a little bit, maybe a lot. It's to give gifts of food to one another, and to just sort of hang out, and, you know, sort of enjoy one another for what that's worth. And what that might be worth is an anticipation of the eternal banquet and eternal perfect fellowship, which is our hope and the promise of where we're all going. So that's Esther. Thank you for hanging out with me through it. And enjoy the party that we're going to tonight, which again is going to be in its own very special way an anticipation of the eternal party towards which we're all headed. And just hang out here, because I think we're going to have Vespers early to accommodate that schedule. But anyway, that's Esther. Thank you for a fun week.